today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 100. We'll be asking if the Dominique Strauss-Kahn scandal marks an end to the French media's code of silence on politicians' private lives.
It's a political earthquake. It's also an emotional shock, which feeds, unfortunately, a great deal of distrust towards the elites.
That was Christine Ocon, broadcaster and chief operating officer at AEF. And we'll be hearing the headlines from last week's European Business Aviation Convention and Exhibition in Geneva.
The traditional corporate market of North America, which is very much based on the big corporations, that's really being replaced very, very quickly by buyers in the emerging markets of China, India, Southeast Asia, the Middle East, Latin America, Russia.
That was Murdo Morris, an editor of Flight International. And later in the program, we talked to Charlie Abrahams, vice president of brand protection company Mark Monitor, who released a candid report on the hotel industry tomorrow.
We ran this study just on five hotel brands, and we found that they were losing close to 600 million visits per annum to their online booking sites, and that would cost them probably well over £1 billion a year.
And now from London, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, May 22nd, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in London for our 100th edition. And I'm happy to say that the original cast is here around the table. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
How are you?
Good.
Should I say who you
are?
I'm
100, so I'm
exactly.
I feel like
it. You're looking great. You missed
here.
It earlier. Rob dashed into the studio with his Panama hat on, and you've kind of got sort of a scarecrow flare going out the side of your head right now.
Have I? I haven't had time to.
The headphones are helping, Rob.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Anyway, Robert Bound, culture editor of Monocle Magazine, Andrew Tuck, editor.
Thank you.
You had quite a week.
Yes,
you've been on a bit of a speaking... We've all been on a bit of a speaking tour. I was at a Goldman Sachs conference this week, 10 years of BRIC.
And?
Well, it was good. It was nice.
And who was there?
there was a smattering of people on stage. There was a whole day session where you had various economists and people from all over the world talking, not just about the BRIC economies, but of course other emerging markets, and an audience of about 300 or 400 people who look at these things all day long. And I was the dessert act.
The dessert act.
Yeah,
you popped out the cake.
I interviewed a gentleman who runs one of the biggest luxury distribution businesses in China, and the girl who designs that collection, Issa from Brazil. Mm-hmm. Then also Simone de Puri from Philips de Puri as well.
God, well, I can't quite beat that.
Is that why were you the pudding act? Does that go in sort of stages?
Why was that the pudding act?
Not the dessert act. Is that how it works?
I don't know. It's just I can only do lifestyle, I guess. I wasn't big enough for the morning.
Who do they have for like starters? A sort of tart herring dish to begin with. Who do they have?
I didn't see the morning sessions. I showed up from Geneva, and we'll be talking about the air show from Geneva a little later. But Andrew, you were. You're at the other end of town.
I was at the other. I was in the Elephant and Castle, which is very glamorous. I went to meet 150 students from the London College of Communication. There was a great debate about kind of the print versus digital world, and I think we won. Actually, I think print triumphed. It was amazing. Actually, there was so many people who were obviously in their early 20s, but who were still kind of fascinated by print and loved print and wanted to get into it. And at the end of the evening, lots of people came running up with their cards and said, "I'd love to come and do an internship, and I love what you're doing at Monocle." So it was great seeing there was still such an audience for people who, like we were when we were that age, defined ourselves by the magazines we bought and thought that it said something about who you were.
Rob, do you think that Andrew dove into the mosh pit as well?
Well, he's sprained his wrist, hasn't he? Which you would have thought would be slightly dodgy, but I think it's from all the high-fiving
exactly.
That was done to him after the talk.
Is that what students do in their early 20s still? I wonder.
What, high five?
Yeah.
Do they call each other daddy-o?
Can I just say that if you're in our office and you're ever going to do anything, don't tell anyone, because Rob was doing like how I should enter onto the stage before I left. He was like doing kind of like rock and roll entrances.
You need to do a little. You sort of need to do a little jog onto the stage.
A little jog, a little
and
like dance,
and a sort of acknowledgement of the crowd, and then sit down. A little sort of shimmy
and a small spin as well, maybe.
Maybe a twirl. Hugo was in favour of the twirl.
Right.
He would be. That's just
the
way he is. Would,
yeah, that's
just
very
the kind
Hugo
of boy
saying.
He is. And Rob?
No speaking for me.
No performances this week?
I was just
always a performance, but...
just, shouting at Poppy, just shouting across.
Right.
Always. But no, no, no professional engagements.
So we did go and see Tracy Emin together.
We did that, didn't we? We had a good art night.
Yes.
Yeah, that was good.
And so the show is the Hayward and maybe, I don't know if Rob's going to talk about it. It's one of those things where someone's so good at PR that you kind of think that's all she's about, really. And then you see all her kind of collected work in one place, and it was actually amazing. It was funny and moving, and
we had a bit of an art dinner earlier this week. We had some friends visiting from Honolulu, and. Well, I don't know. You had sort of the prime position because I couldn't see anyone where I was sitting in the restaurant. But
oh, yeah, we went out for dinner.
You would like this, Rob.
Yeah, it was amazing. So we were in the dinner. There was Lucian Freud sitting on a table just behind us.
Wow.
Which was great. And he looked so cool. And then behind us was Peter Blake, obviously Beatles fame.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, there was an odd connection because two tables away was Cilla Black.
Oh, that's good.
Right.
Yeah.
One of this country's top artists.
Yeah, and then, exactly.
And then, is Blind Date still going as a program?
No.
No. I mean, because I was thinking about it because it's just, in an odd way, it is sort of in step with the times because it's, it's due for a comeback because it's just so wholesome and in the midst of everything else. Well,
but there was a camp connection. They must have known each other in the 60s, Cilla Black and Peter Blake. So
yeah.
It's funny that they're still going out to the same restaurants.
Cilla Black weirdly sort of, I think she's strangely weirdly connected to that world of like quite cool pop stars.
Yeah.
Like Beatles and Stones and then like quite the pop art people. Yeah, weirdly, you're kind of like, da-da-da, and Cilla Black.
So it was quite nice anyway, having people there from Honolulu saying that.
Yeah.
And much of the conversation over dinner obviously focused on DSK Dominic Strauss-Kahn as well.
Yes.
Your view, Mr. Tuck? I mean, we're sort of a good week into this now, so.
Well, yeah, it's not good for him, is it? But what's really interesting is just this national divide, which is, you know, that when you look at the opinion polls and what people are saying about his guilt or not, that already people just divide up along national lines. You know, that in France, his really is, many people do see it, especially the people from his party do see it as a conspiracy. But it's just one of those stories that there's obviously so much more to come out, and it is being played for publicity by both sides. It's an interesting story.
Does it almost read like a bit of a setup somehow?
I mean, well, what's,
not that you want to write a thriller, but
yeah, obviously it sounds like the man has, you know, a reputation, but you know whether that means that he's a rapist is very different, and there is a bit of spin going on both sides, and of course with American lawyers involved, you get kind of this story being told much further in advance of the trial than you ever would in Europe. So we know who she is. You know, we're getting it's already kind of picking each other apart in a kind of extraordinary way.
What do you make of it, Rob?
Well, I tend to agree with Andrew. It sounds kind of too. It sounds too perfect to go with his reputation that it's not a setup. It's obviously Gordon Brown. This is his
exactly.
way of dealing with, you know, this is his IMF challenge. This is how he does it.
But it was interesting looking at the papers earlier in the week. The New York Times had something on Friday. It says, you know, at IMF, and I'm just looking at it online here, men on prowl and women on guard. And it's, you know, as you were saying, it's, you know, not a national divide issue. It's an international divide issue. I mean, this really sort of becomes, you know, the last bastion of sort of, you know, all things liberal on this side of the Atlantic, you know, really versus, I mean, you know, front page business story in the New York Times, you know, which just sounds like the IMF is full of, you know, horny buggers and girls and high skirts.
It's amazing that sort of France has sort of said, it was all very well, la, 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 but, you know, this is classic puritanical America. And it's like, well, you know, he's been accused of rape. You know, that's not puritanical America. That's the same in any country.
Yeah, who knows? We might find out he's guilty. But it's interesting how even the way he appears in court. So he appears in court looking, though he hasn't shaved because he hasn't the shave the night before. So that's meant to make him look slightly bad and things. You know, and so the press saying, oh my God, you know, the downfall of him. He looks, you know, scruffy. Well, they didn't let him shave. It's not that he became a monster overnight.
No.
You know, it's just that they didn't let him shave deliberately. You know.
Well, I guess we should probably get the view from Paris. And joining us on the line now is Christine O'Conn, broadcaster, news anchor, and chief operations officer at AEF on the line from Paris. Hello, Christine.
Hi, Tyler.
I wanted to start, maybe we're one week into this at this point. What would you say is the view from Paris right now? And really, from the man and woman on the street, where does the French public and also the French media sit on this right now?
It's a political earthquake. It's also an emotional shock, which feeds, unfortunately, a great deal of distrust of existing distrusts towards the elites. And there is that ambivalence of consideration and pity and compassion for the wife, the family of Strauss-Kahn, and indeed for himself, and also compassion for the alleged victim, although the political friends of Strauss-Kahn are very shocking at times in not even mentioning her. But I would say the man or the woman of the street feels shocked, doesn't quite understand the way American legal system works, the way American media function. But I would say once the state of shock is over, what will remain is politically a very damaging phenomenon.
I mean, because in many ways, I think you could say, and it's not just from an American perspective, but Brand France and so many of its pillars is really on trial at the moment, no?
Well, I wouldn't say so. I think that you in Britain, you know, you're so accustomed to sex scandals affecting your politicians that, you know, you can't say every time that it's the brand Brit which is being stained. Of course, the French like to see themselves as, you know, world-known great lovers and the gallantry and, you know, as opposed to you, Anglo-Saxon, we know about sex and we're so happy with it. in that respect, it's terrible because it's not a matter of gallantry and libertinage and all those things considered French, which between you and me may not be all that true. It may be a crime. Hmm. And that's another story altogether.
If you were to visit the editorial floors of the newspapers, television, radio broadcasters in France, do you think there's already almost a realignment going on? And as you said, once the shock is over, maybe I should just go back to the earlier question. I mean, you know, in a way, I think a lot of people do look, you know, at the state of French media and this, you know, some would say this code of silence, you know, this unwritten agreement that exists, etc. That a next generation of news editor, you know, even in more traditional newsrooms, is really thinking, you know, we have to change our game.
That's probably true, but it's not only a matter of journalism, it's a matter of law. We have in France very strict privacy laws. And if you write an article saying Mr. So-and-so is sleeping with Mrs. So-and-so or with Mr. So-and-so, immediately, you know, you get into a libel suit. Our privacy laws are much stricter than yours. But it's interesting comparing with what has been going on in Britain about Andrew Marr or Max Mosley, if I recall, going to the European Court of Human Rights. There's indeed also a controversy, it seems to me, in Britain about how far journalists are allowed or should be allowed to go. But I think there's, of course, the editorial dimension, but there's also the legal one. And we operate in a democracy with a set of legislation which compels us journalists to respect them. That being said, it is true that in such a centralized system as ours, there is a degree of empathy or sympathy or camaraderie or indeed very strong networks of people who, in the case of Strauss-Kahn in particular, 1 year before our presidential election, would work very hard at protecting his reputation from all sorts of gossips and even at times all sorts of accusations of sexual behavior going a bit beyond decency. And so that network of people have indeed protected him, including journalists. But again, we also practice journalism within the boundaries of law.
Christine, it's Andrew here sitting in the studio with Tyler.
Yes, Andrew.
I just wondered, there seems to have been a kind of a feeling in much of the French press and certainly among Strauss-Kahn's supporters that there's actually a conspiracy behind this. Is that something that you've tried to reflect on the TV station? Is that something you report? Or do you think that's just kind of the kind of idle gossip that comes about when people are trying to excuse someone's behaviour?
I think that's very much an internet phenomenon. You have all these conspiracy freaks, you know, who immediately go and babble away with all sorts of foolish stuff. It was tempting the very first day because it was also a way to express shock. Let's say Sunday, could he have fallen into a trap? But the moment all sorts of details were known, you know, about the alleged victim, the kind of woman that she is, and not an Ukrainian blonde with long legs, I mean, that conspiracy theory just fell apart, at least for people who have a minimum of rational neurons in their brain. and I think that it's indeed very foolish. What was really disgusting is that it gave way to other sort of very sexist comments, because that's where, you know, all these macho politicians cannot, or journalists cannot, repress themselves. Jack Lang, who was, you know, our former culture minister for years, said at one point, oh, but after all, it's not a murder story, is it? Which is really, you know, quite shocking. And a well-known journalist who spends the past 60 years giving lessons to everybody else said, you know, it's not serious. It's like, well, just using the maid for sexual purposes. You know, what? I mean, really. What is interesting is, in such moments of collective trauma, you have very primitive, deep expressions of machism, despite contempt for women, and coming from people that you would never think would have such behavior.
Christine, hi, this is Rob. I wanted to ask you about the culture of the super injunction, which is happening in the UK right now. You mentioned Andrew Marr and Max Mosley and a couple of names. And we're always told that things are or aren't in the public interest. Is that something that happens in France? Do people feel that they're being prurient if they're looking into the lives of a politician as opposed to anyone else?
Yes, and that, in my view, is really an issue that in our culture here in France has to be looked upon very, very carefully. Just imagine, Strauss-Kahn was indeed very well positioned to become maybe the next president. So all those political friends of his, or indeed all those who were hoping that he would be elected and were obviously ready to vote for him, would have perhaps voted for a man who perhaps is able or prone to such a behavior. And that indeed raises a very important issue, which is, I think, different from what happens in Britain, where it's really a matter of privacy. We have, again, very strict privacy laws, and everybody has the right to protect his or her private life. That's written in our law, and that's different from your system. But I think that for a politician, getting to high office or indeed any kind of elected office, we in France have to ask ourselves, there is a degree of responsibility there, because electing someone, man or woman, who can be either blackmailed or, again, prone to indecent or dangerous behavior, it's a very serious question in any democracy. And I think that the Strauss-Kahn affair, whatever its legal outcome is going to be, will be a landmark in our political culture in that sense.
Christine O'Conn in Paris, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Talk soon.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Andrew, do you think that this this shapes up to be a story, and as we sort of, you know, even as it unfolds over the next week, 2 weeks, that it also becomes something of a cultural holy war as well? That, you know, one side you have a lot of American media outlets getting up on their, you know, rather high horses about, oh, you know, how could the French behave this way, and putting French media under the microscope, when of course, you know, we know that whether it's in the corridors of power or newsrooms, that things aren't so tidy in the United States as well.
Well, I think it's been an amazing week for kind of sex and politics, because what's very interesting, just as this story has unfolded, so is the kind of slightly sillier story about, as unfolded in California, of Arnold Schwarzenegger and his kind of secret child with his housekeeper that went on for 10 years. So it makes you realize that actually, even in the US media and in the US kind of political system, where people's lives are picked over to a degree that's impossible to imagine here, that even there you can have, you know, a child that you keep secret for 10 years, and you can be a one of the most high-profile politicians in the world, in a sense, Arnold Schwarzenegger was, and you can still kind of get away with it. So I think that the American media can't say that, you know, French media allowed him to get away with it, which I think was happening at the moment. Everyone's kind of coming up with stories from his past and saying it's impossible that this wasn't talked about before. Why did the French media not kind of raise their doubts before? But I do think there is a cultural divide. In the past, European countries and European newspaper groups have, not in the UK, but in France and in Spain, and to a degree in Italy, have allowed politicians to have lovers, partners, you know, that they've known about, which they just haven't talked about, and that's been part of the kind of political landscape. But I wonder, after Strauss-Kahn, whether people will be able to get away with that.
Rob, do you think it's also something of a moral crusade as well? Because, you know, when you've looked at a lot of the, you know, the U.S. media, they said, of course, well, the IMF has a completely different code of conduct that we know within the walls of that organization. And I think in many ways saying that, you know, within the rest of the world, outside the United States, it's okay if a boss has an affair with a secretary, a colleague. You know, that's not sexual harassment. That's just people falling in love.
Yeah, I think it is. And it's strange when it becomes, you know, when a story like this kind of falls immediately into the lines of kind of cultural stereotyping. The French call the Americans puritanical, the Americans call the French kind of, you know, libertines. And it's kind of, and it is that stupid thing. We're sort of, you know, we're all guilty of sort of doing it, or, you know, already. Even Christine was talking about it as well. It is that strange thing where, you know, you can feel that the French media and certain sections of the higher echelons of French politics feel, here's one of our brothers, you know, stuck in a cell in Rikers Island, you know, or now he's out on bail, but, you know, he's at the mercy of this justice system, which is different to ours and all the rest of it. And you can see that it's weirdly and quickly falls down into sort of, yeah, cultural and supposedly moral lines.
Mm. But Andrew, do you think that corporate America, though, is perhaps pleased about this because, you know, in a way, it can almost create a level international playing field for, you know, corporations elsewhere? Well, you know, this is the new office norm, and it's been written in Washington or New York, and it has to also then pass, you know, whether it's in South Africa or France or in New Zealand.
It is strange, that corporate culture thing of, you know, offices where you're kind of banned from dating anyone, or, you know, just you know, literally asking someone out for a date in your office could cause a problem. And I don't think that I would imagine within multinational companies it's actually impossible to kind of, you know, move those rules lock, stock and barrel from one nation to another, because it is cultural, and I just don't think you can get rid of it. I think no matter if you're a US corporation operating in France or in the UK, there will be degrees of difference, and I hope so that continues.
We're not a corporation, are we?
No, we're not. It's not going to happen at our office anytime soon.
I was going to say, you can behave the same in Japan or in New York.
Exactly. It doesn't matter where you go, Ross. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly in London. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly. Last week, the 11th annual European Business Aviation Convention and Exhibition, EBACE for short, took place in Geneva. 108 countries from around the world were represented at this year's event, which welcomed a record-breaking 511 exhibitors and 12,500 attendees. Murdo Morrison, editor at Flight International, was there, and he joins us on the line now with his observations. Murdo, hello.
Good to speak to you. Hi.
I was there as well. I didn't bump into you in one of the rather cramped fuselages of any of those aircraft, and that's quite sad.
But there were a few, weren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess a couple of things that when I spoke to some observers, I didn't go last year. I was there the year before. And certainly, you know, some people said, you know, a lot of happy talk, a lot of people really looking forward to, you know, where things are going to be, the order books looking at 2012, 2013, but also that there weren't any big headline stories. A lot of the stands looked the same, et cetera. So there wasn't a huge investment. And I guess, you know, a lot of people still hedging their bets in many ways.
Well, they are. It depends how you judge the success of shows like eBACE. Yes, there weren't any big orders, but these big orders tend to be quite manufactured affairs anyway, in that they're very stage managed and they're planned for months in advance. So it's not necessarily the sign of whether the show was good or not, whether there were lots of big orders for Gulfstreams or Globals announced. I think what was evident to me, having gone to every eBACE since 2001, is that the show was considerably bigger in terms of the footprint. That the halls where most of the exhibitors are were probably 60% bigger, and there was just more of a buzz around. I think what struck me was that there were the emerging markets, and this is something we've been hearing about for years in business aviation, the traditional markets, the traditional corporate market of North America, which is very much based on the big corporations, the Walmarts, the Coca-Colas, the banks, flying around in fairly sort of functional corporate jets. That's really being replaced very, very quickly by buyers in the emerging markets of China, India, Southeast Asia, the Middle East, Latin America, Russia. You know, they are really becoming the big buyers of business jets at the moment. The market's still massively skewed in terms of the fleet that's out there towards North America and Europe. But if you look at order books, it's the emerging markets that are really driving it.
And Murda, do you think that that's both private buyers, high net worth individuals, but do you think that also, you know, whether you are a Cessna or you're a Bombardier or a Dassault, that also there's a hope that this, you know, American corporate culture will also spread, that if you're an Indian company, that, you know, it will make sense that to get around the region, just to get around a country like India, it will be perfectly acceptable. The board will sign off on you having seven aircraft.
Yeah, I think that will come, but I think we're some way off that. I think that culture doesn't exist, partly because the regulatory environment there is very difficult. It's very difficult to run a very cost-effective, efficient air transport operation there, because simply it's so regulated. These countries are coming from a culture and a regulatory background of state-run airlines, and to go into that, and you know, it's very difficult. You have to log flight requests 4 days in advance, I think, in China. It's very complicated. What's driving the market in these regions is, at the moment, is really the high net worth individuals. Now, they're corporate buyers, in that these guys quite often are the head of a huge corporation, of a family owned corporation. And it's these guys in India, in China particularly, that are really driving the market. And it's, you know, I mean, whatever people in the industry say, these are toys, maybe not toys, but they're certainly reflections of these guys' personality. They want a business jet. It's a status symbol. They want something that is going to get them from A to B, but A to B in utter privacy, and A to B in something that they're as comfortable with as they are sitting in their own office or their own palatial sitting room at home.
Mm. I wonder if there's also a bit of a positioning exercise, you know, with eBase. It sits in Geneva, of course, you know, a city which is headquarters to no shortage of luxury goods companies as well. And I was speaking to someone at one of the stands, and they said, it's interesting, it would be much easier for, you know, wealthy, you know, Colombians, Brazilians, Mexicans, to fly up to the United States to the equivalent show there. But they actually prefer going to Geneva because the crowd is just that much more international. You know, would you say that's true?
Very much so. The two shows are very different. NBAA is a bigger show than eBase, but very much more of a trade show. You know, the audience there, the delegates there are much more, it's guys in polo shirts, you know, it's guys who run the flight departments, it's pilots, it's people on the maintenance and the servicing part of the trade that go to that show, and it's a trade talking to the trade. I mean, it's a huge trade, but what you don't get at NBAA is the high net worths. You don't get the guys who fly on these planes. Don't go to NBAA, because to them it's just, you know, it's a service that their corporation provides. It's very, very different at eBase. You do get lots of people with serious suntans and very expensive suits floating around. It's a trade show as well, but you do get that. It's got that sort of aura, and I think it's because it's Geneva, as you say. It's a place where a lot of people in the world come to do business and come to do their leisure as well. Geneva is a great place to have the show in that respect. It's expensive for the likes of me and lots of other people to go there, but it's, you know, that doesn't bother them. It's a great place, and the whole setup of the show with the static on hand and the PAL Expo Exhibition Center just there beside the airport, 5 minutes from the city centre hotels, it really works well.
Murdo, it's Andrew here in the studio with Tyler. I've never been. Can you tell me, so if I was a kind of an oligarch turning up wanting to buy my first private jet, what's the process? Can I take one for a test drive there? Or do I get taken out for dinner in the evening and wined and dined?
I believe so. I've never really quite moved in these circles, but I'd imagine that is how it works. I mean, it's not quite like turning up and picking your aircraft and writing a check, but people will certainly be walking around, so they'll be comparing the aircraft. A lot of the time there'll be, you know, there are people who have set up appointments with the manufacturer's people. So it's not quite as kind of turn up and ad hoc as that. But they are certainly there to look at the hardware available. And yes, and to be wined and dined by the manufacturer's representatives. And if you walk around the big hotels in the on the side of the lake, which unfortunately our expense budget doesn't quite stretch to, but if you are in there to do business, to see people, you will individuals, and you will see the manufacturer's salesman as well. And there's a lot of business goes on at eBase in the big hotels, not just on the convention floor.
Merlo, hi, this is Rob. I wanted to ask you about the similarity with the motors. I've been to Pal Expo for a couple of the Geneva motor shows, and it's the kind of thing that makes experienced motoring journalists and wealthy men, mostly, as you say, in expensive suits, sort of turn into children again and sort of sit in this kind of like gullwing Mercedes and kind of essentially make car noises almost.
Yeah.
Is there
absolutely
a sense you see,
I've been to the Geneva motor show as well. I think it's slightly different in that, yes, a plane, a business jet is a very different proposition to a car, and it's more expensive than even the most expensive car. So it's a different step up again, really.
People aren't queuing up to kind of sit in the pilot seat, though.
Yeah, and I think it's important to bear in mind that a lot of the people from these emerging markets are not necessarily coming at it from the... They're not pilots. I mean, everyone is a driver. Everyone drives a car. So these high net worths will be coming and looking at... whether they want to buy their Bentley or their Ferrari or whatever. But a lot of these high net worth individuals at Ebis will not be pilots. They will be very successful, very wealthy, self-made, almost entirely men, the odd woman. But they're buying it because of the cabin. They're buying it for something to be flown in and something to fly their friends and family and associates in. They're not really, and this is very different again to North America, where a lot of people, because of the way the aviation industry in America has grown up, there are a lot of people who train to be pilots, who come out of the military. A lot of people fly small aircraft. And then successful ones graduate up to bigger aircraft. So there's much more of a known-a-flyer culture in North America and to a smaller extent in Europe. When you go to China, when you go to India, very, very few people know how to fly. There's not that own-a-flyer culture. So it's looking at the aircraft from a slightly different angle as you would looking at a luxury car.
Finally, just before we go, Murdo, what would you have, or what were people driving off the lot? And if they did up your expenses at the magazine, what would you drive off the lot?
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, there are some pretty amazing aircraft. I think as an owner pilot, I'm not a pilot, but if I were, I think some of the aircraft at the low end. We haven't heard for some time now a lot about the very light jets. That was the real hype a few years ago, and that didn't really touch eBase at all. And that whole bottom end of the market has been pretty much decimated, really. You know, the even up to the likes of Cessna, Hawker Beechcraft, really struggling at the moment to find customers because these are aircraft that just aren't appealing in the emerging markets. And I think what if you look at the likes of Bombardier with the Global and the Challenger range, you look at Dassault with their new Falcons. They introduced a new Falcon at eBase, the Falcon 2000S. Gulfstream as well, having a few problems with their 650, of course, after that very tragic test flight crash. But they're the ones really making the running. And I think something that really put into perspective the way the market is at the moment was Dassault. And they were saying that there are 10,000 aircraft, business aircraft in North America. There are just over 100 in China, and yet half of Dassault's order book at the moment is from China.
That's an amazing fact, and I think we should probably leave it there. Murdo Morrison, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Talk soon. Bye-bye. Andrew, I was. It's interesting when you go out on the static display, because I went and I had lunch with one of the companies, and then they took me on a tour outside of the Pal Expo, and I learned the greatest term because, of course, you know, you're getting your sales pitch on one side. What do you think the aviation equivalent is of curb appeal?
I don't know. Is it a pun on is it a runway romance or something like that?
No, we were looking. I was looking. I was with the people from Bombardier, and one of their heads of public affairs showed me one of their Challenger aircraft, which is, you know, is largely a plane which can get you across the Atlantic, and it's, you know, it's for captains of industry who have to fly, you know, around Europe and around North America in great comfort. And then we went and looked at, you know, as Murdo was saying, at one of their Global Expresses, and you see that it's largely the same, you know, fuselage, a little bit more volume inside, but this aircraft is, it's substantially taller, you know, just due to the landing gear, and there is certainly a sort of a stature that this aircraft has. And I commented on this to the woman from Bombardier, and she said, "Oh yes," she goes, "you know, this aircraft has fantastic gate presence.
Gate presence. Ooh, I love that.
Is that good?
Yeah.
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 To which I said, Ms. Boudreaux, I said, do you really, can you say that with a straight face all the time?
Yes, exactly. Did she?
She nodded and smiled. I think they had a good show as well.
That's good, isn't it? That's like sort of packing something, isn't it? He's got a good gate presence.
Yeah.
It's funny what Murdo says about the China order book, though, is how many luxury brands and how many watch companies and how many, you know, all kind of getting increasingly dependent on Chinese orders. It's extraordinary.
Well, and that, and again, with so many of these companies, and Bombardier is, you know, is one as well, we're also... that they're also doing a lot of manufacturing, or certainly, you know, striking joint ventures as well with companies in China. Aside from gate presence, the other word or set of words that I like as well is flight department. Andrew, I just have to run to this meeting because I've got to just run down to the flight department.
That's good, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I think we've got space for a flight department.
Everyone needs one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, sort of multiple screens, watching weather patterns, etc.
Uniforms? You thinking uniforms?
Would they? Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if they have to wear, I don't know if the flight department needs to wear uniforms in the office, but. But I mean, so we'd have, you know, fantastic outfits for the pilots. Anyway, I did leave because also, you know, I sort of packed myself onto a Swiss flight back to London after that, and thought, God, it would be much nicer on a Global. I don't even need a Global Express. I just need a Pilatus. I need a Pilatus PC-12.
Oh, you know you want already.
Absolutely. Pilatus PC-12 is a European runabout because, you know, it can sort of land on, you know, grass strips, etc.
Oh, that's good. I like that.
Yeah, so you want something sort of, I think, you know, sensible rug. It doesn't have to be too fast, but
and are we having a monocle M on the tail, or is it just
no? I think it's more TB. Discreet. No, it's not TB. No. I think it's sort of more discreet.
Okay.
Right side of the door, I think.
Okay.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on our aviation shopping tour. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where it's time for culture. With Rob Bound, 100 shows later, and I brought my sleeping bag because you did get the email that you're going to do your top 100 now.
Oh, wow. This is brilliant.
Right?
I was going to do that. I need to put on a different voice for that.
Yeah, you do. Really,
yeah.
What are you going to play?
Can you remember what we played on the first show?
I don't remember what we played on the first show. Did we play music on the first show? Yeah, they're nodding. I can see them nodding through the double glass. Mm. Are you queuing? Is there a surprise?
No. So that's actually a genuine question.
I know there's some
that should be done off air.
There are some
question.
Audio surprises at the end of the show. A little
later
on. Yeah, there are, absolutely.
Nice.
Anyway, but I'm no one's holding up any signs, so I don't know what we played on the first show. But what are we going to play on today's show?
We're going to play Kitty, Daisy, and Lewis.
Okay.
They're siblings, two girls and a boy. They've got a very 50s look. They've got a bit of a kind of.
Which one's the boy?
Daisy.
Right.
When you're a child and your mother dresses you in a dress. That's what happens.
Yeah, it's where are they from?
They're from North London.
Oh.
They're from exotic suburbs of North London.
Right.
And they've got they've kind of make new music that sounds old, I suppose. Mm. They're a bit bluegrass, they're a bit country, they're a bit rhythm and blues. Not R&B, rhythm and blues. They're different nowadays,
great,
aren't they? If you say you like R&B, it means you have to have like a sort of few lines shaved down the side of your head.
That's
it?
Right.
That's what that's about. Maybe diamond earring. anyway, Kitty, Daisy and Lewis, and this is a track called I'm Sorry.
Should we get you a croissant before we go as well?
I've just had my Danish, actually.
Okay.
It doesn't look like it belonged to my...
No, it doesn't. But let's play the song. It sounds familiar. Have you been listening to that in the office?
Well, I've had some similar-y things on, but it does sound very scary. It sounds like almost rock steady-ish, doesn't it?
It's of its moment. It's of its time.
Mm. But as you say, it sounds kind of like we've just kind of tuned into some weird sort of radio station in St. Lucia in the 50s.
Yeah, and it's funny that it is North London.
Yeah, but it's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
You like?
Yeah, very much.
Very
Andrew?
Charming. Very good.
Yeah, I love it. I was just going to say the same. It's one of those funny records that if someone said date this, it'd be really hard if you didn't know who they were. You'd think, is this the 50s, is this the 60s, is this the ska revival of the 70s? You know, it's really funny.
I'm a bit concerned, Rob. I can see sort of Andrew sort of bouncing down the street with the windows down.
Yeah.
Pork pie hat.
Pork pie hat. Yeah. He's basically, he's turning his
one arm out the window.
Rude boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were you going to change the masthead? Should we just for one time for the July August
issue? No, or we can do it for Monocle on Med as well.
Rude boy talk.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly what I want to see. Anyway, and the record, by the way, the LP is called, and I'm going to call it an LP because it does sound like it should be called an LP
absolutely.
Rather than an album. It's out on the 30th of May and it's called Smoking in Heaven.
Very nice. Yeah. I liked it.
We like it a lot.
Yeah, it's cool.
He's been playing something else that's funny in the office this week, which has divided the office down the middle. Chili Gonzalez.
Yeah. Well, we might have to have that on the show, actually. He's Chili Gonzalez of kind of quite mellifluous, kind of rocky, electronic-y, all sorts of different stuff, has made a sort of a rap album. And it's got the funniest, rudest lyrics ever.
Yes.
And I think we could probably get away with it on this programme.
Right.
We?
Go ahead.
Well, I don't think we can say many of them, but there's things like you are the housewife, I am the appliance.
Right.
So you're playing it in the office and suddenly there was one time which we were very lucky because you came through with the guest. And
yeah, you came through with the guest and so the stereo boomed out, I'm an ass man. And that was and so those awful moments where you can always cheer, you can always know when an important guest is going to be shown around the office when the stereo is going to play something really off key, or just basically shout abuse at whoever it is.
That's almost the same as when many years ago, in the days of wallpaper, when we had this very, very conservative, crowd of not board members, but senior advisors, came over to visit from New York just shortly after they purchased the magazine from Time Inc. And it's interesting, going back to Murdo talking about those men in polo shirts, who walk around air shows in the United States. It was the same type of thing, like literally the Time Inc. golf shirts in their multi-pleated chinos walking around. And my assistant at the time was Emma Parker Bowles. Mm. And she walked into the office. I hadn't seen her that day. And she just had a T-shirt that said, "Enjoy cock." I was okay, right.
That's excellent.
Sort of the same, isn't it?
That's very good. That's very good. It's straight into the point.
Do you have a cardigan, Emma? You could just put on for our guests.
Did you have to turn the air conditioning up so it was like 5 degrees in the office?
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, you're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly here in London. A candid new report out tomorrow claims that leading hotel chains at both ends of the market are dramatically losing out online to fiercely competitive internet booking companies. Authored and published by brand protection company Mark Monitor, the report demonstrates how significant web traffic, revenues, and customers are being siphoned away from hotel brands by online travel companies in a process they call brand jacking. Joining us now in studio to tell us more is the vice president of Mark Monitor, Charlie Abrams. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you. Good morning, gentlemen.
What was the origin of this? Because it sounds like that potentially Starwood or Hyatt or Four Seasons commissioned this and did it really start as a study because there was this creeping suspicion that this was happening. Where did it start?
No, it actually wasn't commissioned by any particular client. We run what we call a brand jacking index, kind of every 6 months on a particular industry. And we thought the travel industry is very interesting from an online perspective because, I don't know about you, but I haven't been a travel agent for quite a few years, actually a high street shop. You tend to book things online these days. And our business is about helping major organizations protect their brands online. So we thought it'd just be interesting to look at the travel industry. And we were pretty surprised at some of the results we got, actually.
And what are some of the headlines so far?
Well, one of the headlines is we ran this study just on five hotel brands, but I think you could extrapolate it to pretty much any part of the travel sector. And we found that just for those five brands, they were what we'd call losing something like close to 600 million visits per annum to their online booking sites. And that would cost them, probably extrapolating the kind of industry figures we used in this, well over £1 billion a year.
And this is because they're not, because they're having to pay commissions via other sites. Is this the issue? Or
it's partly the commissions paid to affiliates and agents, but it's also partly people who go out with the intention of booking with, Hotel ABC. And when they put that into a search engine, up come a whole load of sites which are advertising site ABC, but they're also advertising tons of competitors. Mm. And of course, I've done this myself. I travel a fair bit. You go look at the site and you think, oh, that one actually looks a bit better, or it's got a better price. Mm. And you end up going somewhere else. Mm. And so they're just losing to competition in some cases.
Right, but this is obviously not end consumer focus, or maybe the end consumer doesn't really care because, you know, all of these sites, I would assume, are better for the consumer, or no?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any harm to the consumer here. The consumer gets good choice. He may end up, you know, being the subject of a good marketing campaign and not booking exactly the hotel he'd gone out to buy, which I guess could be a loss to him, but is more important, obviously, to the brand owner because, you know, this person came to the internet with the intention of booking in, you know, Hotel ABC and ended up booking in Hotel XYZ, which would be pretty irritating.
So if you're one of the, you know, the major groups, if you're, you know, if you're Accor, you know, if you're a Hyatt, et cetera, are there recommendations and, you know, what do you need to do as a brand? And as you said, I guess this really goes across the entire sector. It's airlines, it's everybody. I mean, what has to happen, do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that they need to do. One of them is to start focusing on this, which I'm sure they do to a certain extent. But actually, it's very interesting. We work for some companies in the travel sector. The one that I'm closest to is not actually in the hotels business, but they have the same issue. And we found that when we started working with them, they were able to look at the terms and conditions they've got with marketing affiliates. So these sites that you find these brands on, which are not their own, are actually, you know, got some kind of contractual relationship with the brand owner. Mm. And after they'd looked at this and seen just how much commission they were paying to people where they'd gone to an affiliate site, booked through that, and then paid some amount of money to the marketing agent, they realised that actually if they put the right things in their terms and conditions with the affiliates, they could probably get less of the traffic to go to the affiliate sites and more of it to go to their own.
Mm. Andrew, are you feeling bad for Hilton at this point?
So the interesting thing is you're saying that they allow these relationships to grow up themselves. So in a way, that it's not brandjacking in the sense that someone coming along and stealing their content. They've unwittingly entered into relationships that they didn't realise how they were going to be abused. Is that correct?
That's right. In the majority of this, we did find a significant amount which was related to what we would call traditional brandjacking, illegal use of the brand. But the majority of the sums that we're talking about is exactly what you just said, which is the ecosystem of the internet, as it were.
And have any of the brands been much stricter in how they control their relationships? Is there a hotel brand that's actually said, actually, we're not going to work with affiliates. If you want to come and book a night in our hotel, you have to come through our site?
To be perfectly honest, I don't know. I mean, you see that with insurance. I mean, another big online sector. If you see the advertisements you get on TV these days, you'll see that some of them are saying, we're not going to participate in Money Supermarket. You know, you can only get the best deal from XYZ Insurance Company if you go to our own site. So maybe that's something that will come, interestingly, as they become more aware of it. Mm.
Rob, have you been brandjacked lately?
I don't know. I think
you would know.
I felt some gate presence. I don't know if I've actually been fully brandjacked. I actually wanted to know the sort of definition of brandjacking, because you said that you work in sectors other than hotels. And I wonder what an example of it was in another sector, actually.
OK, I'll give you some really simple examples. We would term brandjacking as the abuse of a brand on the internet. And that could be anything from fraudulent activity, like people trying to steal the consumer's bank account details through what's termed a phish, which is, you know, you get an email saying your password's expired at NatWest or whatever, and then you're lured into giving up your credentials. That's, you know, one of the kind of most egregious forms of it. But right through to, you know, buying consumer products. We work for a lot of consumer brands where people, again, are increasingly buying stuff on the internet. I think the travel and insurance sectors are the most developed in terms of the internet. But people are even buying luxury handbags and things like that on the internet. And the vast majority of stuff that's out there that's advertised is, you know, fake. There's quite often a lot of stuff out there that is not the genuine product, let's put it that way.
Mm. On that note, let's say if it's also, I mean, I think one thing you also see a lot now is just this sort of constellation of affiliated brands. So someone is trying to sell one product, and then you might see, you know, a tower of, you know, these are our other brand partners down the side. And I would imagine that, there's a lot of sort of bleeding at the edges that way where, you know, I have nothing to do with that company. You know, why the hell is my logo there?
Yeah, that's true. And one of the things I find most irritating as a consumer is you quite often put a well-known brand name of almost anything because, you know, you research even if you don't buy on the internet and you keep get driven to these what we call pay-per-click sites, which is people who've just bought a domain name with a popular brand associated with it, and then they populate it with advertisements for genuine products. and they reap money every time somebody clicks through to them. But as a consumer, I find that irritating because I'm not going to something that's actually going to... It's kind of an intermediary that's getting in between me and the product or service that I'm trying to get my hands on.
Just at the top end of the market, if you're talking about luxury goods or hotels or, you know anything that's sort of, let's say, part of a premium experience, do you think that you're going to see a greater emphasis, sort of people closing the walls in a way and saying, you know, I want to control, you know, the entire experience, you know, back to front. And in fact, the power of my brand, I don't need to be part of an affiliation or a confederation of other brands. Is that what's going to happen?
I think in some sectors, affiliate marketing will still be hugely important. I think travel's one of them because, you know, it's always had an agent kind of culture and structure to it. I think in what's interesting in the luxury goods sector, and as I say, we work for some of the luxury products manufacturers, you know, what they're seeing is they've been slow to get online generally in my experience. You know, it's only in the last year or two that you could go buy very expensive watches or handbags from the genuine brand owner site. And in that period, believe it or not, the brand jackers, or in many cases, in those cases, criminals, have kind of jumped into the void and set up sites called cheapburberry.com. There will be a site somewhere called cheapburberry.com. I bet it doesn't belong to Burberry.
I'm sure not. Charlie Abrams from Mark Monitor, thanks very much.
Good. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly in London. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where I thought we should maybe take a small trip, skip down memory lane.
I love memory lane.
Yeah, memory lane's a good place.
It's got overgrown, but...
It is.
I love skipping, so we're all sorted.
Now tell me, how many cities do you think we've done this program from? Guesses.
How many cities? 10 or 12 different cities?
Yeah, I think 10 or 12.
10 or 12? Almost 20, 19 cities.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. Vancouver, Geneva, Stockholm, Helsinki, Los Angeles, Washington, New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, Palma de Mallorca, Sydney, Brussels, Frankfurt, Beirut, Rio, Madrid, Milan, Seoul, Honolulu. Not bad. I mean, it's almost all the time zones.
Yeah.
Rob, do you want to start? Are there any sort of shows that stand out for you?
Well, for me, I love meeting one of my heroes, which was David Byrne. It was a great pleasure to have him.
Right.
Not just on the phone, but in the studio.
He was in the studio, exactly.
Talking about his new records and talking about his songwriting process, having beers with Fatboy Slim, and getting sort of almost arrested for doing so, lying by the Hudson River in New York. Yeah. Sounded quite idyllic and quite amusing. So that was great. That was a good one for me. I don't know whether we'll hear some music from that.
Okay.
But I also like some of our more stupid and punny. I like the blooper tape stuff. I know you've got a few of those up your sleeve.
That's coming up. But if we have David Byrne, let's have a listen.
Well, I was interested in doing something maybe in the back of my mind about a kind of powerful person and what drives them, how they justify everything they do and that sort of thing. And then I heard that she loved going to discos and nightclubs, and she had a mirror ball in her New York apartment or her New York townhouse and all that. And I thought, wow, if there's a story there, it comes with a soundtrack.
Yeah.
And, you come to this with a lot of preconceived ideas about this person, and many of them are true. But I thought it's interesting for the music to persuade you and take you into their point of view.
Mm, very nice. And he was talking about Imelda Marcos there.
Yes, not Fatboy Slim.
Not Fatboy Slim, no. It was just, what a storyteller.
Yeah, very cool guy.
And he was sitting exactly where you are now, Rob.
Yeah, exactly. Andrew?
Well, I wouldn't mind going back to the very beginning, actually. I would. It's funny how, you know, when you...
Well, you mean the first show?
Yeah. Because it's funny when you look through the magazine now, it's kind of changed when you go back to issue one and... And actually, many of the things that we're talking about now are exactly the same as in issue one. I think issue one is always a good benchmark of what your ambitions were. So I wouldn't mind going back to the very beginning.
I wonder if our
ambitions
were that high.
I wonder what the ambitions were with first issue of Monocle Week.
Hello, and welcome to this first edition of the Monocle Weekly. I'm Tyler Brulé. It's Sunday, December 28th, 2008. Ahead on today's program, author and philosopher Alain de Botton is here to talk about why happiness is not just a personal issue, but a political one.
There is no wealth but life. So concentrate on your portfolio of life and not on your portfolio of cash.
That was Alain de Botton, who'll also be telling us a bit about his forthcoming book. And after that, our very own culture editor, Robert Bound, will be here with a few music and filmic tips to keep you going through the holidays, including this.
I'm standing on the edge. I'm looking over, swaying from side to side.
We'll be hearing a bit more from the Phantom Band in a moment, and we'll also be crossing to Oslo shortly to speak to Martin Schenke of the Norwegian Finance Ministry about the finer points of managing state wealth. But before that, I'm joined here in London by a few of my Monocle colleagues, including our editor Andrew Tuck, Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson, and our culture editor Robert Bound. In a moment, I'm going to ask you all about the stories you're keeping an eye on over the year ahead. But first, Rob, good Christmas.
A very good Christmas, thanks, Tyler. Very good.
God, it was quite lo-fi then, wasn't it?
Yeah, bless. I didn't know. I forgot Willow Wilson was in the
I know
office.
Willow was quite, Willow. Yeah, she was in the mix.
Auntie Willow.
Yeah.
Can I just say, the best picture during that was looking at Rob's face, trying to remember who that track was.
I love the Phantom Band, but it was quite a dour choice for our first show.
I was going to say also for the time of year as well.
Yeah.
It was Christmas.
Yeah,
exactly. No, it was also, and there was a bit of controversy when we relaunched the program, and Gaynor Howell started doing the announcement. A couple of people said, "Oh, you sound a little bit too grand now." And then when we remixed the music as well, but I don't know, it sounds a bit empty when I'm.
Yeah, it does
actually.
Yeah. It does. It's one of those weird things. You know, when they sort of redo the news, and you kind of then you watch the old titles for the news, and you kind of go, "Oh yeah," you can see why things have to move on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Your turn to make a pick.
My turn to make a pick. I thought one of the most extraordinary guests, and this is someone who's also become a regular in our stores, was Lord Peter Mandelson when he came into the studio. And it was just interesting to see someone who, you know, of course, you deal with, you know, aides and advisors and et cetera. And then he sort of wandered into the studio and he took his moment and no one was going to rush him.
You know, it's tough in our economy, and what we've got to focus on the whole time is our absolute determination to get through this ghastly global recession and make sure that we're in a strong position to take advantage as a country, as an economy, of the upturn, which will come. And the way to prepare ourselves is to focus on three drivers, in my view, of strength for us. It is our innovation, it's our entrepreneurialism, and it's our ability to spot new business opportunity. And all those three things are interlinked. And people who say to me, look, the recession is the last moment you want to be thinking about creating a new business, I say the opposite. You know, you don't want to just start thinking about creating a new business when the upturn's already begun. You want to do that in advance of the upturn.
That was Peter Mandelson there, we need to get back into studio. Hopefully we'll see him maybe at our party later in the month.
He should have a chat show as well. He's got good voices.
He's got a good voice, but it's quite hypnotic, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I think that's probably the point.
I think so.
It's a nighttime show.
Yeah, exactly. Hi to all you truckers out there.
Rob, any more from you?
Well, I wanted to take you back to LA, which we always enjoy going to. It was a brilliant show for lots of reasons. Far be it for me to say it was a brilliant show, but I enjoyed the show very much for a number of
reasons. Well, we liked it also because the stand-in for Chris, we had an amazing sound engineer.
He was brilliant, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was great.
What was his name?
He was Leo. It was Leo.
Yeah, he was really, really cool. And because it was PBS, wasn't it?
No, NPR.
NPR, rather.
NPR Studios, yeah.
And yeah, he was very amusing. But we had a number of good guests on. Matthew Schreyer, the KCRW DJ, who was super cool.
Yeah.
We also had Simon Miller, the jeans designer.
Yes.
On, who it was very amusing and had a very spunky Kiwi sense of humour.
Yeah.
And, we gave Andrew a dressing down or a dressing up, I'm not quite sure. I'm going to say just a few words, and you could just have to reply to them with yes or no, or good or bad, or right or wrong.
Okay.
Remember, just in my view, certainly this is only my opinion.
All right. Stonewash.
Dead to the world.
Zips.
I can't even look at you straight.
Come on, I said one word answers.
I can't talk to you.
Elasticated waistband.
Oh, yeah, I do. I love them.
Sort of an embroidery.
Oh, yeah, as much as possible.
Excellent. We've just described Andrew's jeans.
Yeah, exactly.
with the action side panels.
Oh, yeah.
You just really described fall 2011.
I've got one more word for you. Dungarees.
You shouldn't have worn them today.
Touché. Never make fun of your editor.
No, exactly. I think we need some more Kiwis on the program.
Yeah.
Can I just say that there was a visit. Long after that, we were in Tokyo, and a very nice Japanese subscriber came up to me, and she was like, "Are you okay on that show? Do you worry about how you get picked on?" I was like, "No, it's okay, don't worry." She's like, "I feel sorry for you. It's because of you beast."
on that note, what about Andrew setting up a bakery stall? I think that that one has hung around. I think that was very early on. It was I think it was the 20th show we did. I'm going to ask you both a question. If you weren't doing this job, Andrew, what type of shop would you open?
Oh, God. I think partly through doing Monocle, I've kind of really kind of admired the kind of people who run great kind of food stores, you know. And I still think in London, when you, most neighbourhoods, there's like one great food store or one great place to buy cake or, you know, we've looked at some of those companies in the magazine, but I really do think that wherever you go in London.
Andy's Cake Shop.
Yeah, Andy's Cake Shop. Tuck's Buns.
You'd buy them.
Love it.
What do you think about Tuck's Buns now? Have the goods settled in transit, or are they still as pert as they were on the original show?
Are they still fresh, or have they gone stale?
No.
I like how serious you were to begin with.
I know.
What was I on?
Where were you going? What were you on?
On, actually? There's another one I wanted to ask you about, which was a show that I sort of guest hosted.
Right.
Or you were on something in St Moritz.
Oh, this is
you
when
were
I...
on the mend.
When I had my knee operation. By the way, I'm actually having another knee operation. So we might have to.
I'm
be
looking
doing
forward
show.
To this. No,
you might be standing in again while I'm up in the mountains. Let's have a listen.
I've got something that I want to play for you.
Okay.
And you're supposed to just guess what this is.
Okay. So we're worried already.
What is that?
You've had your leg amputated. You've only got one leg left.
Surprise.
It's called hip hop, not hop hop, Tyler.
What is that?
One more time. That was speeded up.
You've taken up clog dancing.
No, it's a little Swiss wooden goat.
Ah, well, how did we not get that?
Right?
Playing ping pong.
It's on my desk.
Playing ping pong with itself.
Okay, wait, one more. What's this one?
That's a big wooden goat.
Exactly.
I get 10 points. 10 points.
Oh, dear.
That's amazing. They give you very strong drugs when you have that knee operation.
I know.
It's an amazing advert for Swiss pharmacy.
It is.
I like this, how you were slightly impatient and so said, no, I'll do it again. As if we were meant to get it.
Perhaps we should end with, there haven't been too many cringeworthy moments in the studio, have there?
No, actually, it's always been...
But one will always come to mind.
It's the only time we've had a guest walk out of the show.
That was really
it wasn't storming out, it was just walking out, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We didn't really reveal it at the time. We covered it at the time. But
we didn't have to pick a chair up at the end.
But I think we have... We've worked through it, and there's distance.
Out of this very room. Well, he tried to walk out, but it's slightly complicated getting out the door because it's a double-locked door, so there's a bit of fluffing to get out the door as well.
Yeah. And he was here to promote a book which dealt with the affairs of the Middle East. And he's quite well-known as an author.
And we didn't ask him a very tricky question either.
No.
Anyway.
He was in a hurry.
The government is now trying to address
Rob, do you want to ask your question? Go for it.
No, yeah. Sorry, I'd like to leave. Sorry, I just not in the mood.
Ready?
I'm very sorry, yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm worried about my signing.
Okay.
I want to leave. Yeah,
okay.
That.
Okay.
All right. Sorry about that. Thank you, bye.
So awful! Oh, Jesus! Oh, that was well and truly horrendous.
I can't do it. And you go, really?
I fired you. Question like, okay, Rob, go, ask a question quick. Like, tackle him.
What I like is that phrase. It's no good. I can't do it. It has become a kind of a phrase that's used in our office probably once a week ever since.
At least, yeah. Can't do it.
Okay.
Oh, dear.
Highs and lows.
How the fun we've had.
Roller coaster.
Yeah.
It's been fun, kids.
It has been very fun.
It has been amazing.
Yeah, it's got another 100 to go.
I like it.
Yeah, it is good. We were also looking at the schedule for our future audio plans as well, and we've decided this program will probably go to 2 hours in its Sunday format when it's live.
We need more music. Some rustling of newspapers. Yeah.
I think so, definitely. Maybe one or two people around the table.
Will there be a buffet?
There will be a buffet. You've scoffed back to your Danish. Andrew, how many croissants have you had this morning?
I've had the one, but it got me in the mood for speaking to Christine Orton.
She's very good.
I love her.
Highlight guest of the day.
Yes.
Murdo's always good as well.
Murdo's very good, yeah.
But I think Christine can have her own program.
Although I prefer Murdo when he's got kind of a plain kind of noise going over the head.
Yeah, a couple of Raphael fighters.
Actually, that would have been another good kind of perfect moment when he was nearly bombed by a plane going over his head.
Yeah, exactly. It was a bit North by Northwest.
Well, if I didn't have these headphones on and we didn't have the microphones in the way, I would call for a group hug, but it's going to be complicated. It's sort of there's going to be cables and gussets and all sorts.
It's going to be more complicated than storming out of the studio, isn't it?
That's for sure. Anyway, that's all for this 100th edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Alex Mills. And Alex has also done 100 shows as well, which is amazing.
Yeah.
We never really hear from him except when he sort of ventures out into the field with his microphone from time to time. And our sound engineer, Chris Sharp. Let's hear it for Chris Sharp. And
well done, Sharp.
Well done, gentlemen. And we've been doing this at the Sound Company for all of these years now. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember to catch up with us daily via Monocolum. And issue 44 is on newsstand, and we're finishing issue number 45 now, which is quite something. And then we move on to doing Monocle Mediterranean. But it's going to be holiday time for all of us very soon, which I'm very much looking forward to.
Yes, I haven't booked anything either.
We can sort that out. I actually, on that note, it was quite funny because when we were talking to Charlie earlier in the program, Mr. Abrams, when he said that, I don't know about you, but because he hasn't been into a travel agent, but we couldn't function without a travel agency. Without Giles Travel, where would we be?
I know. Well, we call them every single day, and they're amazing. So
we'd be well and truly brand jacked.
Yes, exactly. So also a big thanks to them as well because they do get us around the world. Next week, we're in London still, as we're on production. But for now, in London, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Robert Band.
Goodbye.